From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we recap some of our favorite interviews from Full Plate, our summer-long series on agriculture in southeastern Wisconsin.
First, we'll look back at our conversation with food contributor Kyle Cherik, who takes a deep dive into the history of Wisconsin agriculture.
Then we learn about an unlikely project to plant rice in southeastern Wisconsin and get a lesson on dairy economics.
It does not take a very large change in milk production, change in exports, or demand result into $1, $2, $3, $4 change in the milk price.
Plus why bees need cities and cities need bees.
Our urban areas and our cities have more biodiversity and are more abundant and offer a more diverse diet for the bees than you'd think.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tike. Like most major metropolitan areas, there was a time when most of southeastern Wisconsin was farmland. And while the area that surrounds the city of Milwaukee is today home to suburbs and exurbs, there is still much evidence of our agricultural heritage, in many cases, a living heritage.
This summer, Lake Effect is exploring what agriculture means to our region in a series we call Full Plate. We start the show today by examining the history of agriculture here, a topic that Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik knows quite well. He explains how geography played a key role in our agricultural evolution.
The lake and the river have a great deal to do with it. I always like to say that we've got one hip pressed against all that fresh water and then another cheek pressed against one of the seven great rivers of the world, right? So that's a major reason why. People forget that really until the end of the 1800s, bit 1870s, 1890s, Milwaukee was the premier Great Lakes port. Cleveland and so on and so forth were really important. But as far as a Great Lakes port, we were the one that everything was shipped out of. And primarily what we were shipping was wheat. People don't think of Milwaukee or southeastern Wisconsin as a wheat kind of town, save for the grain exchange where people go and have terrific weddings and events. But we were an international market maker. And it was really head-to-head with us, between us and St. Louis. But we were kicking chaff and taking names for years and years and years and years and years and years. And I mean, for instance, the Civil War, the North may not have prevailed if it weren't for the wheat and the pork and other produces that were shipped out of Milwaukee and went through the chain of the Great Lakes to supply New York and the northern cities. It's that big of a deal because of the blockade of the Mississippi. There's those two waters again. So wheat, which we learned from the Dust Bowl, we were early to realize this in Milwaukee and just west of here, is the single most depletive crop you can grow en masse. It just takes everything out of the soil. So as a way, to make a long story short, of reinvigorating that soil, in come the pigs and the cows. Pigs will eat almost anything that grows, and they give back a lovely style of fertilizer. The pork barons came in, the Cudahys and the Laytons, et cetera. And then the dairy came in really by the ethnicities of the folks that were coming to Wisconsin, and specifically southeastern Wisconsin at that time, that had a dairy background. And cows are great because they give you cash flow, or rather they give you milk every day, but then you can sell that milk. And if you can breed that cow, then you can get more cows, ideally, and so on and so forth. But out of that pork and dairy industry grew our agriculture. So you need to grow things to feed them. You realize that you need to rotate those things and have cover crop. Well, if you've got that cover crop like soy, which we are one of the biggest producers in the world, you've got that to sell. You don't just throw it away. If you're feeding some to your animals, you make more. So between rotating between corn and wheat and soy, those are the big three that we do, that's where we have heavy, heavy agriculture. I mean, people don't realize it, but when the national freeway system came through with Eisenhower, Wisconsin as a state had more paved roads than any other state in the Union because our farmers needed to get their produce and their grain and their animals to market.
So with all of this historical input and background, When did we start diversifying? Because we're still a heavy dairy state. We still produce meat. We still produce bigger crops like that. But we seem to also have moved into things like cranberries. We've talked about cranberries before. We have all of these other kinds of organic farms and things. When did that shift start happening?
Right. Well, a part of it really started in the 20s. And then it moved on, of course, through World War II and the Victory Gardens and that sort of thing. And that's when everyday people got more involved with it. Folks that had moved to the cities started planting Victory Gardens. But really, it was that changeover, I would say, early 20th century. Now, I mean, we don't think about it, but we are fifth in the country for mint oil production. Right.
I wouldn't have known.
You don't realize how many sweet potatoes we grow. You don't, you know, those sorts of things. When you look at census data, and we're getting close to another one, but when you look at census data, and there's the categories of food jobs, and they've got, I think it's 26 different, you know, that they sort of split it out to, we're in the 90th plus percentile for all of those jobs in southeastern Wisconsin, except for two. So all of that processing, all of that work that comes with, what are you going to do with the soy? What do you, you know, because soy, you can't eat it in and of itself. It's toxic at first, unless you steam them, and then you can do edamame, but you have to break it down from there. All of that, what do you do with the hogs and the hides and the dairy and the, when you raise beef, well, when you have milk cows, you know, that mom has calves, they either have a male or a female. Well, what do you do with the males? Oftentimes they become veal, right? Strauss veal is one of the premier providers in the globe, and they're here in southeastern Wisconsin. And so there's all these ancillary aspects, and then all the diversification and growing, because if you've got a 900-pound gorilla doing wheat, soy, and corn, well, let's kind of mix it up and do one of these variation crops and so on and so forth, because the infrastructure is here, the people to buy it is here, the, I hate to say it, but the herbicide and pesticide dealers are here, the flavoring companies, we don't think about it, but malting and flavoring and all of these things that go into our, you know, global food system, five of those big heavies of the top 20 are located, headquartered in southeastern Wisconsin.
And you think about that and you think, it truly is a breadbasket.
Right. Oh, yeah, big time, big time. I mean, people drive into downtown Milwaukee and they don't realize when they look at some of the tall buildings that ADM Coco and Kerry and others are here. And these are people that are participating in a billion-dollar way in the global food system, but they're headquartered or have significant offices here in southeastern Wisconsin. And they are because of the infrastructure, the institutional knowledge, the legislation, the just predisposition towards food. And I'm not talking about brats and beer. I'm talking about the technology. If you need a really good chemist within flavorings or malting or brewing or those sorts of things, they're probably walking down the street in downtown Milwaukee or one of the suburbs right now. So, it, you know, your labor pool, you don't have to hire from across the globe. They're right here, because this was a degree that they could get or they were just naturally interested in it. In the same way that Silicon Valley just, you know, creates programmers out of the,
they just, out of the ether.
Yeah, they just walk out of coffee shops every day. Our food institutional knowledge is just walking around. It isn't sexy per se, but it's part of who we are. And I don't think we do really as dynamic of a story. We're doing better with the food and beverage cluster and things like that as part of the Milwaukee 7. We're doing a much better job in telling that story. But it's not as engaging as saying mason jars full of canned preserves and, you know, that artisanal side, which is a little bit more.
Well, that's fun, too.
And, yeah, and absolutely.
And that has grown as well. But it grows out of this foundation.
Right, right. And here we have a long tradition. I mean, I grew up in Waukesha. I grew up in a pretty big family, and we canned and we preserved. My parents had a relationship with a family farm, and we would buy a whole cow, have it slaughtered, you know, cut up, that sort of thing. And they had a huge, what's uneloquently called a coffin cooler. And there would be an entire cow in there, and they bought it at a great price, and we ate, I think, premier beef through the year. But this was normal to us, and the fact that we had asparagus when it was fresh, and then we pickled a whole bunch of it, and that was just one of the things that we did with corn and beets and so on and so forth. This was just every day for most of the people that I knew growing up. And I grew up in a suburb, but I don't think, it, you know— looking through my grade school classroom, probably 50% of the people, their parents made a living in some connection to an agrarian lifestyle or industry.
Do you think that's changing, say, for your kids or their kids? Are there still going to be that same kind of percentage of folks working in the food industry, the agricultural industry in southeastern Wisconsin?
I think it's changing, at least in the suburb that I grew up in, just because the suburb has grown so much and now they're starving for water. So that's its own discussion. But I do think it's changing. But there's also a counterbalance in the community gardens and, you know, homegrown success with Tim McCullough here in Milwaukee. And they're just popping up neighborhood gardens like right and left. And the interest in canning. I mean, this is a little apocryphal, but in some of my research trying to figure out just how much has canning grown, since 2009, I can tell you that there's been a 300% increase in mason ask jars sold.
Wow.
Well, I would have thought it would be more. Now, a lot of cocktails and tea lights are going into those things, too. Let's be honest. But all you have to do is go to Amazon and type in canning and look at all of the publication dates, right, of these books that have come out since about 2009, 2007, 2006. So that interest in preserving your food and knowing where it comes from, and a testament to my television show that I host, Wisconsin Foodie, it's essentially the story of where your food comes from. So I think there's a counterbalance to that. Whereas I grew up, my uncle was a farmer. My brother-in-law was a farmer. I mean, I knew these people. We drove past the Golden Guernsey Cow on the way to go shopping. That doesn't happen as often, but I think there's a connection to our food that then's filling in those gaps in a different way.
Well, it's a story that has not found an end.
No question. It's this food is the story of humanity. When we domesticated crops, 10,000 roughly BCE, it changed everything. And we've been living, for better or for worse, in sync with that experience and either heeding it or fighting with it ever since. So it will never grow old. Tell me one human experience, whether of great celebration or of sadness, that isn't also touched by food or drink. I challenge any of them. Send me an email. I mean, we soothe with food. We celebrate with food or drink. This is how we reconnect to the land, whether it might not be as that direct that it's the mead from the bees that you grew, though that's cool, or raised. But, you know, it informs who we are. And here in Wisconsin, we have deep, deep, deep roots in identity. So much so that I think we even take it for granted at times.
Well, Kyle Cherik, I never take you for granted.
Oh, thank you, Bonnie.
And I'm always happy to have you in the studio. And you'll have to come back towards the end of the summer and the end of the series, and we'll kind of wrap up and see where we've been, the travels that we've taken through our agricultural history here.
So it's fresh rhubarb now, and I don't know what we'll bring in when it's in season. Ooh, at the end of the summer, right?
I don't know. You'll have to surprise me.
Good.
Thanks, right. Kyle.
See you later.
Kyle Cherik is a writer, host of Public Television's Wisconsin Foodie, and a regular Lake Effect contributor. You can find more segments from our Full Plate series by heading to WUWM.com.
A Vermont man returns home to Wisconsin with an unlikely agricultural mission. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Rice is one of the world's staple foods and one of the most widely eaten, especially in Asia. The UN reports that rice is the agricultural commodity with the third highest worldwide production. But for all of Wisconsin's agricultural prowess, rice has not been a crop produced here. Well, at least not until now.
As part of our Full Plate series on agriculture, Lake Effect's Susan Benz takes us to an acre plot in rural Ozaukee County, where a Marquette University scientist by the name of Michael Schlappe, along with several students and Hmong immigrant farmers from Laos, are taking the next step in Wisconsin's commercial rice production.
Marquette student Kristen Stannis appears both bewildered and amazed as she looks at the evolving rice paddy on what was formerly a cornfield outside the city of Mequon. A tractor moves back and forth through the field, leveling the land, while a cluster of women, wide hats protecting their faces from an intense midday sun, deftly plunk clusters of seedlings into the mud.
I started in, I think, 2 weeks ago.
Great.
And we've just been planting today, just going through the motions of planting, and I guess I'm more learning about rice farming, what it takes, what we're putting in, all the efforts that we're doing. And
Stannis is a biomedical sciences student interested in business who was invited to come aboard as a project intern.
As the process moves forward, I would say just evaluating just all of our expenses, all of our cash flows, mm-hmm. and developing it into a business model for what we're doing here.
Stannis's boss, scientist Michael Schlappi, says he was able to bring on interns, pay them, and buy some basic equipment thanks to an innovation grant from the university. Schlappi experimented with rice varieties from around the globe for 5 years, testing how they stood up to Wisconsin weather in miniature paddies he built on his lab rooftop on campus. He settled on a short grain variety from Russia. 2 years ago, he took the experiment to a farm field outside Port Washington. A story we produced on the experiment made its way as far as Vermont, where it reached the ears of a rice farmer named Eric Andrus, who today is on a tractor in this field, breaking up soil as Schlappi watches.
He sold me this machine.
The 3-horsepower mechanical transplanter manufactured in China, Schlappi is standing next to.
So we have a relationship. He's kind of my consultant. But around the same time as I got interested in this, he got interested through a workshop that he learned from a Japanese farmer in Vermont. He's actually doing it commercially now in Vermont. But he heard me 2 years ago. That's how he made the contact. Wow. And I think this would not be at this stage, because 2 years ago he asked me, what's next? Because he looked at the small paddies at the Fondy farm in Port Washington, remember? And we were, I mean, they were small, right? It was just more like, see if this can work in Wisconsin. But this is actually production size. So this is commercial production. This is intended for commercial production. And I could only do it with the grant from Marquette to involve the undergrads, like my interns here just talked to. I have several biology interns as well who work on this. You know, and I try to pay them well so they're happy and hopefully stay with me for the duration of this grant.
Vermonter Eric Andrus climbs off the tractor for a sec. He grows rice on 5.3 acres back at home.
Which is small by most any standard, but we're hoping for better than 10,000 pounds of rice sales this year. So that goes a long way towards constructing my annual income. Eventually, I'd like to expand to maybe about 10 or 15 acres, but probably not beyond that.
Like Schlappi, Andrus hopes to inspire others because he says there's no way he can personally scratch the surface of the demand for high-quality rice.
Michael and I have been corresponding for a while, so we've been sort of working up to this moment. And I also have a personal connection to Wisconsin because I attended high school and graduated from Whitefish Bay.
Did you?
So yeah. It's a sort of my old haunts here, and now I'm coming back here to plant rice. So it's like, my goal is to plant rice coast to coast. It's like so funny.
Andrus has experience in working with farmers who know far more about rice growing than he.
In Vermont, we have a Nepali refugee community, and those people are also very passionate about rice. Okay. So I have had those folk doing work sometimes on my farm. I've attended rice events where they also attend. So there's a little bit of cross-pollination all around, and they're from Southeast Asia, not Central Asia, but the atmosphere is very similar. My hope is that we can all kind of develop this together with some ideas imported from overseas, some developed locally, and some brought in from, you know, the cultures that these people have brought with them.
Here in Wisconsin, Michael Schlappi says fruitful partnerships have helped him get this far. When he first ventured out to Port Washington, he used a bit of land managed by Fondy Market, a long-standing enterprise in the heart of Milwaukee. Fondy Executive Director Jennifer Casey has formed a relationship with Mequon Nature Preserve, where Fondy is farming space in the preserve's northwest corner.
20 acres here, and we would love to expand. We could not meet the demand for the amount that we had 33 farmers that wanted to farm on site with us this year, just word of mouth.
So remind me what the arrangement is.
We rent the land. Fondy Food Center rents the land from Mequon Nature Preserve. Yep, and at Port Washington. Mm-hmm. We in turn rent out the actual land, parcels of land, maybe it's a half acre or an acre to farm family. And they also, in addition to paying for rent for the land have access to our tractors. We do all of the tilling in the spring and then again in the fall. Our farm director, Stephen, is probably the most important resource that they have access to. And so he's on site a couple of days a week to help troubleshoot, make sure that the equipment is working correctly or if any training needs to happen. So we offer a suite of resources. Of course, we're looking at getting irrigation up and running for the entire farm this year.
The Mequant site is a mere 13 miles from the market, far closer and more convenient for Fondi farmers. Casey says she's on the lookout for more affordable land small farmers can count on one year to the next. She says the Fondi Farm's original purpose was to ensure farmers at the market had access to quality land on which to grow. She sees the rice project fitting into their mission.
I've talked to several of the farmers here today who have not planted rice or worked in a rice field for 20 years. And everyone that I've talked to is enjoying themselves, including these young men. You should definitely talk to them, Susan. I mean, I think that they could better tell you in your own words, but of course many of these ladies were growing rice in Laos before they had to become refugees and before they came to this country, before they fled to this country. And we had an outpouring of interest at the rice trial plot at the Port Washington farm. Pi, in the red there, she's experimenting with her own test plot with rice that she brought back from her sister who grows down south. But the cultural significance, I mean, rice is found in not just cuisine, but art and folk stories of the Hmong culture, the Hmong people. It's an important food. Obviously, there's the tying the community together because harvesting and planting is a communal process.
Pai and her fellow farmers are knee-deep in mud and too busy planting to pay me any attention. Chu Sang Vang and his two brothers stand at the sidelines, passing the women flats of seedlings or smoothing the soggy earth when directed to do so. Vang's parents are farmers, but they're not here today.
So what do you think about this process?
This process right here is kind of slow, but I can see how they started when they did it in Laos and how my parents grew up into doing this. So
have kind of a special feeling, or does it just feel totally foreign because it's something you didn't do?
Yeah. Because I come here like thinking like we're going to use a machine and all of that, but then we're going to do this one by hand. So I get to know how they felt when they were doing it by hand back in Laos.
So have you tried it yourself?
Yes, I've tried. It's kind of...
How's it feel?
Slimy. Really slimy. I'm not really good at it, but I'm slowly learning.
Vang is studying film and video production, but says when he can, he helps his parents, who sell at Fondi. He finds this rice planting experience, slimy or not, moving.
It is hard, but it's a little bit rewarding too, because you have to get to see them, because like I said, my parents own a lot over there, so I usually help them. So I can probably come down here and see how the rice are doing.
Michael Schlappi looks on and smiles as Vang and his brothers assist the women. They're beginning to take ownership of their section of paddy.
The section they're standing in right now, it's really wet. And they kept complaining that it's not leveled, the field is not leveled enough. But now I see them hacking, you know, they use a hack to, or a hoe to take pieces from the berm and push it into the section that's not flat enough. So they're taking matters in their own hand to make flatness out. I think they want to win the context in terms of yield, which they might, you know.
That wasn't Schlappi's original position. He thought machine planted would conquer. Altogether, 250,000 seedlings were nested into the soggy earth. And Schlappi says if all goes well, it could yield a couple thousand pounds of rice. We'll let you know how that turns out. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Michael Schlappi is a scientist and associate professor at Marquette University. He was joined by several of his students and Hmong immigrant farmers in conversation with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz. There's more information on their project at WUWM.com. We'll take another break now and then meet a young woman working to introduce underserved Milwaukee neighborhoods to urban beekeeping. That comes your way next on 89.7 WUWM. of Lake Effect Now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Growing food doesn't always occur in the country. From city-based commercial operations like Growing Power to personal backyard or even balcony urban vegetable gardens, urban agriculture in Wisconsin's largest city is booming.
But no matter where they are, the one thing all gardens have in common is the need for pollination. And when we think of pollination, most of us think of honeybees. The rooftop of Redeemer Lutheran Church at 19th and Wisconsin is host to three flourishing hives. Maggie Stang is one of the people who helps maintain them.
Stang joined me in the studio earlier this summer to explain how she became a beekeeper.
I just graduated from Marquette University, and during my time at Marquette, I helped out at a meal program at a church called Redeemer Lutheran Church on 19th in Wisconsin, and we have a lunch meal program most days of the week for anybody in the neighborhood who needs a warm lunch. One day, I was there finishing up, cleaning up with some of the other students, and the pastor there, Pastor Lisa, said to me, "Do you want to come meet the bees on the roof?" I was like, "What are you talking about?" And so we went up to the roof, and there I saw a beehive, and I met a beekeeper named Charlie, and he was speaking about the bees in such wonderful mystical terms and explaining the ways that they pollinate our neighborhood. And really, from that moment on, I was absolutely hooked.
Did you know anything about bees before that?
I knew the minor stuff that most people know, you know that they're important for pollination, but then I didn't know the extent to which they were so important, and also how just amazing they are and their communities are. And then I heard a few months later that the church was hoping to get some of the meal program guests involved in the beekeeping on the roof. And that's when I knew that it was something that I needed to be involved in, because I really loved that meal program and had gotten to know a lot of people there.
So this is agriculture and social justice all rolled into one.
Yeah, we definitely try to keep it community oriented as much as about bees.
So you have a couple of hives up on the roof. How much honey does that produce?
So we have three hives on the roof, and each hive is a different type of hive. So one is called a top bar hive, which is best for educational purposes. Produces a little bit less honey versus a Langstroth box hive. It's kind of what you picture, you know, those white boxes stacked on top of each other, people in bee suits.
And then you lift up.
You lift up those and put another one underneath. And those can produce, you know, gosh, a given you're up to, you know, 100, you know, pounds of honey, more or less. Kind of depends where you are and what the year looks like. So we do jar and sell that honey out of the church, but a lot of our work focuses on the community education aspect.
So how are people reacting? I mean, most people think of bees as things to stay away from.
Right.
You know, particularly if they've grown up in a city, you don't want to be stung and you think this is just some insect that's going to hurt me.
Definitely. And I think that a big part of it is what we do is we try to explain the situation. We kind of explain to people that given our current agricultural system, where the bees are out in our fields, where we practice agriculture, it's actually harmful for them. For a variety of reasons, the bees are dying and they're being weakened. And so in reality, even though you wouldn't assume it, our urban areas and our cities have more biodiversity and are more abundant and offer a more diverse diet for the bees than you'd think. So when we practice urban beekeeping, we're creating healthier bees and allowing people to have a better idea of where their food comes from and kind of think about, you know, is my food local? Where am I getting that from? Is my food as healthy as I think it is? And kind of brings people together around those conversations as well. So we try to explain kind of holistically the whole situation and kind of lure people up to the roof to say, you got to meet them. You know, they're not going to bug you. They're actually defensive. And unless they feel threatened, they might throw you a sting, but usually not. And when we describe to people that it's an issue that involves every single one of us, we all eat, we all value our fruits and veggies, then people feel kind of immediately included. And when I explain, you know, how magical they are, they kind of get a little sense of curiosity. And overcoming that fear on the roof is something that's really special to witness.
Talk a little bit about that magic. What makes them magical?
Gosh, there are so many things that make bee communities magical. So there are a lot of working parts. Most people are familiar with the queen bee, and they think that she kind of runs the whole show. But it's really about everybody working together. And while the queen does lay all of the eggs, it's all about what the worker bees are doing. So, I mean, it's hard for me to think of another community, another species that creates their own home and their own food, and also has a symbiotic, mutually beneficial relationship with basically everything around it. So not only is it creating that fruit so that we can eat it, but they're going home and creating that their own food from that pollen, and they're creating their own homes from that pollen and that nectar. And they're incredibly resourceful. They're not wasteful. Every bee has a place in the hive. Every bee does its job to its full extent. And I think that's just something you don't see that often. And I think being able to see that helps us think about, you know, how can our communities be more resourceful? How can our communities be more community-oriented in the way that everybody has a place, everybody has a voice, everybody is cared for in a greater way? And so that's been really inspirational for us, is how can we learn from the little bits and the little specific things bees do to help each other be more community-oriented.
Now, is there a particular type of honeybee that you're working with, or are there different species of bees that help pollinate?
Yeah, there are lots of different species of bees. We're working with the honeybees specifically in our hives, but you'll also see, you know, bumblebees are those fuzzy, larger ones that kind of bumble around, and they really are solitary, so less community-oriented. There are carpenter bees that you'll see, other ones as well. And then, of course, people always associate the wasps and the hornets, which also live a little bit differently, and they create their nests out of different things like paper and not.
But are they pollinators as well?
Yeah, especially the bumblebees and carpenter bees. And yeah, they definitely play their part. But the honeybees are responsible for up to a third of what we eat. Usually is what we say, you know, one every three bites that you eat was probably pollinated by a honeybee.
So I understand, you know, you said you graduated.
Yeah.
And you're going off to Minneapolis in the fall. Is that correct?
Well, I'm from Minneapolis, just graduated from Marquette. And in the beginning of August, I'll be going out to Tacoma, Washington. And I'm doing a year with the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. I have an AmeriCorps position, and I'll be working out there. And one amazing thing is that there's a church down the road from where I live that has a bee project. So I think there was a little bit of fate involved there.
A little synergy happening.
Yeah, so I'm excited about that.
Do you hope to continue with apiary studies?
Yes, absolutely. I think that bees are a really amazing unifier for people, and that when you think about how we all are connected to the plight and cause of bees, you can really bring together some different perspectives that aren't usually in the same room. You know, whether it's a beekeeper who's been beekeeping for 15 years, or a college student, or somebody who just got housing after being homeless for 5 years, or a kid from down the street. You know, when you're all on the roof and looking at bees, we're all learning together, and we're all thinking more seriously about our part in our environment and in our city. So I think that it's something that I can stay involved in wherever I am.
Are you hoping that the people that you work with here, that they'll take up urban beekeeping?
Yes. So, I mean, the great thing about urban beekeeping is that there's a spectrum of involvement. Maybe you just want to be someone who has a small victory garden and you're more conscious of what you plant. Or maybe you want to help out, you know, on the roof of the church down the street, and you want to learn a little bit more about bees before you get your own hive. Or maybe you're ready to jump right in and get a hive and take care of it. So there's a range, and we find that people kind of inch closer and closer. And then when they do get that hive, we like to help them out and make sure that it's thriving.
Say I have a little patio on my backyard, and I've got some trees, and there are certainly birds around, and I've seen butterflies and that sort of thing. How do I set up a little hive, both for myself, if I want to harvest the honey, but also to make sure that the bees are healthy?
Sure. There are a variety of people in the city, like, for example, Charlie, the beekeeper I work with.
Charlie Keenan?
Yes, Charlie Keenan. Mm-hmm. He could help you get set up with a hive. It'd be a specific type of hive, like you said, based on what you want. If you were more focused on, you know, a little bit of honey and pollination for your neighborhood, he'd probably set you up with a top bar hive. He'd position it in a good spot for you that's considerate of where the bees come and go. And beyond that, this is what Charlie would say, is being a beekeeper is about being a pattern recognitionist. And so what you generally do is you're trying your best to let the bees be and do what they do, because they know it better than we do. And then you're taking note of what's going on inside the hive so that you can help them do their job better. So when you're looking through, you're noting, you know, where are the baby bees, and where are they storing honey, and where are they bringing in pollen, and is it getting a little bit crowded in the hive, and do you need to add a bar or two so they can grow out to avoid a swarm in your neighborhood, to have your neighbor call on you? That's the kind of thing that creates healthy bees and creates a nice little supply of honey for you and your neighbors at the end of the season.
So if people want to come to the church and see the hives that are there, can they just show up or come for lunch, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I would say come for lunch, or, you know, on Sundays we try to do, you know, after church and after lunch, sometimes we bring groups up for tours. You know, feel free to drop us a note too. You know, today we had a group of 27-year-olds from another church up the street, and, you know, the next day we might have a group, you know, of 10, you know, elderly people from down the road. So we're really open to anybody who wants to come see the bees, as long as they've got a curiosity.
Well, I am so happy that we were able to get in touch and get you in here to talk about this. Thank you so much, Maggie. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let me tell you about the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees and the moon.
Maggie Stang recently graduated from Marquette University and headed west to Tacoma, Washington, where she'll spend the next year as an AmeriCorps volunteer. She is one of the 12 people featured in the Local Lights cover story of this month's Milwaukee Magazine.
The beehives that Maggie spoke about are on the roof, right under the steeple of Redeemer Lutheran Church at the corner of 19th and Wisconsin. You can find out more at WUWM.com.
One more break, and then we'll learn about the many factors that contribute to dairy pricing in the United States. That is when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It may come as no surprise that much of our agriculture is wrapped up in dairy. After all, we are America's dairyland. But despite the moniker, Wisconsin is not immune to the market forces that drive the price of dairy both here and throughout the country.
You might notice when you go to the grocery store, the price of milk varies a lot. In fact, it changes so much that it's routine for some groceries and delis to post the price outside of the store, like signs at a gas station.
So what makes the price of milk so variable, and what does that volatility mean for the dairy state? Lake Effect's Joy Powers spoke with dairy economist Bob Kropp about the different factors that go into deciding the price of dairy products.
I can boil them down to three major factors, really. Of course, one is the level of milk production, how much milk we're producing. And the second would be demand, our domestic demand, how our cheese is selling, butter, fluid milk is selling, how many dairy products are selling. And a third one, which is relatively new, they say new, started about 10, 12 years ago, is exports of dairy products. We used to export some dairy products, but usually what we were doing is government subsidizing exports to get rid of excess surplus milk. But now it's a real part of our demand situation, and so we are exporting 14 to 15% of our milk supply. So whether exports go up or down is a big factor in milk prices. They were weaker last year, so we had lower milk prices. They're picking up now, and so we're seeing a little stronger milk prices. So I say the three things: production, demand, and exports.
And exports. What happened about 10 years ago that changed that, that made exports a much bigger part of the U.S. dairy market?
Part of it's tied to our federal dairy policy. From 1950 up to the mid-1990s, the federal government supported farm milk prices at a relatively high level at times. In particular, the late 70s and early 80s, it was a level that encouraged farmers to produce a lot of milk. We had surplus milk. In about 1980, 81, the government was buying 10, 12% of all the milk, or buying up butter, cheese, non-fat dry milk off the market to hold the price up to farmers. And that was accumulating, so to get rid of it, they went for Food for Peace, different programs like that would subsidize and get it on the market. That program changed, and so from the mid-1990s on now, we do not support the milk prices at that level. So market forces drive our milk prices now rather than the government program. And the industry gradually got involved, the dairy companies, cooperatives, and private companies, to start looking at the international market. So they have grown developing products and become more active in trade. And, of course, we have also established a U.S. Dairy Export Council, which helps the industry seek out international markets. The government has trade assistance programs as well. So now many companies look at the international market as part of their real market rather than just trying to get rid of some surplus dairy products.
You mentioned inside of that that in the 90s, the federal subsidies really ended. One thing that when I was talking to people about dairy prices in general that seemed to keep coming up was how volatile the prices sometimes seem for specifically milk. Why do dairy prices seem to change so much from week to week and sometimes even from day to day, it seems?
Well, it's driven, I say, by market forces. We do have a substantial change in milk prices month to month, you said, year to year, since the 1990s, since the government got out of the program. And a lot of price volatility and uncertainty that farmers have to deal with. And it's kind of tough on farmers at times because we've seen some awful low milk prices in recent years. Even last year, prices were not very good, especially the first half of the year. So milk is very sensitive to relatively small changes. I mean, it's a perishable product. Farmers got to milk the cows every day. It's got to go to the market. And milk we drink goes through real fast. You can keep cheese and butter a little longer. But you can't store it like corn or wheat or something, wait for better prices. And demand is relatively inelastic. And consumers don't respond greatly to price changes. So it does not take a very large change in milk production, change in exports, or demand to result into $1, $2, $3, $4 change in the milk price. It's hard for farmers to understand that, but it's basically a highly perishable product that's got to move through the marketing system fairly quickly, and a little bit too much, prices are down, a little bit shortage, and prices go up. So a great deal of price volatility. And we started in the mid-90s developing futures markets where you farmers in industry could hedge their cheese, butter or on the futures market or milk. Class 3 futures, for example, price risk management tool to deal with that. We didn't have that prior to that because the government provided the price stability. So it doesn't take big change. And there's some psychology in the market, too. We think that, like the cheese market, if they think that cheese is building and it may go lower, buyers come real soft and only buy as they need. So that kind of lessens demand. The price may go down, or the opposite of things, the prices go up, they buy ahead and drives a little higher. So, but through time, it's the market forces, the supply and demand situation that is going to drive those prices. But you have times, for example, this is last week, the price of cheese, which is good news, has increased quite a bit the last couple of days. And evidently the buyers are thinking that, well, we're moving to summer, it's getting hot. Hear about California, it's very hot out there, some cows even dying out there. California's a big milk-producing state. Maybe the supply and demand is going to get tight on cheese, and maybe I ought to buy ahead a little bit. So the market has gone up the last few days.
So right now, to that point, what does supply really look like? What are we getting from specifically Wisconsin?
In Wisconsin, we had a very strong increase in milk production last year. We went up about 3.5%. That's a lot of milk. In fact, we had 30 billion pounds of milk, and we were down to 22 billion pounds of milk back in 2004. The industry has been growing. And of course, you had stories. We ran out of plant capacity due to Canada stopped buying some ultra-filter milk from us. So right now, it's slowed. I mean, we're growing, so far this year, we're growing less than 1%, which is still a fair amount of milk. But last year, everything was ideal. The weather was ideal. Feed quality was ideal. Cow's milk, very good. What's more important, well, Wisconsin supports what they do because we're the second largest milk producing state. And what California, number one, does has a big impact on the market. But nationwide, we're growing about 2% over a year ago, and that's quite a bit of milk. And we can withstand 1% or so growth in milk production to keep farm prices fairly decent based on domestic demand. But if we get over that, we need that export market to market some of that product. And we're seeing right now our exports picking up, and that's good news.
But as you mentioned, Canada stopped buying some kinds of milk for a bit. This was something that came up with even the president. It's something that made national headlines. What was that situation? Because it wasn't quite clear for a lot of people.
Well, we had a trade agreement several years ago with Canada. And at that time, milk protein, ultra-filtered milk protein, where we take some of the water out of milk, maintain basically the protein in that milk, and that's good for cheese making, and because the protein in milk, well, as the butter fat determines cheese yield. If you take a lot of the water out, it improves the efficiency of cheese making. You don't have all the whey and stuff that comes out of there. Well, that product didn't exist at that time, so it was not part of the trade agreement with Canada. Canada has a very protective market. They support milk prices to farmers at a relatively high level through a quota system that controls their production. And it's well above world market prices, so they need to have import protection because their prices are so high. Well, it wasn't under there. And also, with the production control in Canada, milk production does not grow in Canada. And there were cheesemakers up there wanted more milk to supply the market, not only in Canada, but the world market's growing. And so they were buying this ultra-filtered milk from Wisconsin, mainly Wisconsin and New York, two states where there were companies. We had Grassland in Wisconsin that really geared up and supplied that market. It amounted to about 1 million pounds of milk a day to go to that market, quite a bit of milk. But anyway, the government said, you know, we just soon have our cheese plants use our milk. Rather than bringing us milk in from Wisconsin, even though the cheesemakers really liked it because it was a good way to make cheese. So they changed the pricing system up there in Canada so that the milk in Canada, they created another class, Class 7. Milk in Canada is now just as cheaper than bringing it in, so it doesn't pay to buy from us anymore.
How did that dispute and really the outcome there, how did that impact dairy prices here and really the market conditions?
It was devastating for those farmers that lost their market. They have, unfortunately, others picked it up, but maybe at a lower price, what have you, than they were getting originally from grassland. But the overall price was not impacted that much, since prices are driven on a national scene, more so than this what goes on in Wisconsin. It was not a big impact on the price.
So the Trump administration is mulling over some tariffs. As a kind of a response to that, officials in Europe and around the world have threatened their own tariffs. And one of the things that's been brought up is dairy, tariffs on dairy exports. Is that something that you've heard about? Is that something that you're concerned about?
Well, yes. I mean, as I said, that if we're going to continue to grow the dairy industry, and not only Wisconsin, the U.S., our domestic demand is growing slowly. Fortunately, we eat more cheese every year. That's a bright spot, yogurt. But we can withstand about 1% growth or so. So we need an international market. And we're, you know, been involved in trade negotiations with the European Union and others. In fact, there was a trade agreement that President Trump said we'd not be involved with, which would involve several countries. European countries, but Japan and New Zealand and Canada and others, we need to be involved in those trade negotiations so we have favorable trade, fair trade, and some countries are very protective of their markets. We're trying to break those down to expand trade. So our two largest markets are Mexico and Canada. And there's a lot of talk about NAFTA, which was a trade agreement several years ago between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. And that has removed the tariffs on products from U.S. to Mexico, for example. And they by far are our largest market, particularly for non-fat dry milks, skim milk powder. And so trade is extremely important, and the trade negotiators will have future ones working out with it. European Union just developed a new trade agreement with Japan. And that concerns us a little bit because Japan is an important market for us. And so if they have more favorable trade there, we may not have as much export from the U.S. to Japan that impacts us. So we're concerned about, you know, our trade negotiations and what other countries are developing in trade negotiations.
There's been conversation, you mentioned NAFTA, there's been conversation about renegotiating NAFTA or even, you know, removing it and then finding a new kind of trade agreement. If NAFTA suddenly went away, what would that mean for dairy farmers?
Well, if we done away with NAFTA and removed our ability to export like we are now to, say, Mexico, that would be quite devastating. That is by far our largest market. Actually, Mexico and Canada have been accounting for about 30-40% of our total dairy trade. So if somehow they retaliate it, stop buying from us, whatever, you take that amount of exports away from us, we would see the price of milk drop substantially.
Well, Robert Krapp, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and speaking with me today.
Okay, thank you.
Bob Krapp is a professor emeritus and dairy marketing policy specialist at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. For a forecast of the U.S. dairy market, you can head to WUWM.com for a web exclusive with Krapp. And that is Tuesday's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.